Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Last year, we had reoccurring episodes featuring Joe Overdevest, portfolio manager and director of research, joined by members of his equity research analyst team. Today, Joe and host Pamela Ritchie are joined by research analysts Nick Belmare and Max Adelson. This expert panel will look at what is next for cryptocurrencies, expand on this asset class, and look at how blockchain has changed business models. Joe, Nick, and Max discuss if clients could benefit from this, and how Fidelity has positioned itself in this new space. Max points out that Bitcoin has now been around for 13 years. Joe believes we're still in an early stage, and points out he feels fortunate to work at Fidelity, which he says is forward-thinking. Also, Nick will expand on how many central banks are now looking at developing a central bank digital currency. Today's podcast was recorded on February 4th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
So I'll begin with you, if you don't mind. Can you sort of situate us within this, how early we are in really the discussions, the process, the discussions around Bitcoin? Fidelity Digital Asset Service has been in the mix for some time. You know, just give us a sense of timelines. Are we still early in the process?
Thanks, Pamela. We are early. So luckily, we work at Fidelity, which has a great reputation of being forward thinking. So, and as you mentioned, at a corporate level, we've been looking at Bitcoin and digital currencies for a while. And of course, at the equity investment level, even, you know, the fixed income asset allocation levels, we've been looking at it. And we'll talk about that because there's opportunities, but there's also risks as well with digital currencies. So we're very, very early on. And it's a time to almost think big because you just don't know what could be available. And I'll remind everyone, Google was not even the first search engine. It was Ask Jeeves and others. So like even the Bitcoin we talk about today, in a time period later, we might not even talk about because a second or third blockchain, fourth, fifth that we haven't heard of will come and take its place.
It's really interesting. Max, I'm going to go to you first. Actually, bring us into the loop a little bit on sort of the discussion around Bitcoin miners, why we need to know some of this backdrop, if you will.
Yeah, so this is a great discussion. And Bitcoin, we've known since 2008, since its creation. And during that period, we've witnessed the increase of its adoption. But the protocols of Bitcoin, the original white paper that governed it, talked about the gradual increase in supply over time. And the supply comes from this source of mining, which is a cryptographic process of solving for an equation that completes the Bitcoin blockchain. It completes the entire system. And that process allows for more coins to come into circulation. The mining process becomes economic when the price of Bitcoin goes up and influences more people to invest into the ecosystem. And that's why we see these parallels between mining in the physical world and mining in the Bitcoin virtual world.
It's absolutely fascinating. And Nick, I'll bring you in on this a little bit. You know, at the moment, there's not much regulated here. I mean, you sort of expect at some point that might come. But just, I guess, from your perspective, looking at things from sort of a financial side of things, a regulated side of things, you know, where are we? Again, very early stage, I'm assuming.
Yes, absolutely. We're still very early stage. And the way I look at the landscape, I would say in three buckets. You have the crypto native companies that have emerged in response to the Bitcoin. So you have the miners, Coinbase as a large exchange. So these ones are really revolutionizing, and they've emerged because of the emergence of Bitcoins and blockchains. Then you have the existing traditional financial players like PayPal or Square, for instance, that have traditional products, but are adding blockchain capabilities. So for instance, on PayPal, you can now buy Bitcoin. Actually, the CEO of PayPal said yesterday that customers with crypto accounts tend to log in twice as much to the to their accounts. And finally, you have the traditional banks. A lot of banks actually are not embracing Bitcoin because of that regulatory uncertainty and the fact that it's a potential disruption, because now you have new rails to store, transfer, and coordinate capital that are completely decentralized, don't rely on the traditional centralized systems as we've built. And so all of these buckets are trying to find their ways through the new regulatory pathways, and it's really in flux at the moment.
So I'll ask you to sort of comment broadly on the potential for, I mean, financial services to come in here. I mean, you just mentioned there are certain issues with how this is all going to work, but the idea that perhaps in a 60-40, there's a place for a Bitcoin account to act as savings to an extent. What's sort of the early architecture that is on that is going on this or being discussed?
Well, I think early on, there's probably three things that are missing. For obviously, as a financial institutions, they want to see with their clients as well is, number one, more regulation. It's especially in the U.S., clear regulation of, you know, is it a commodity? Is it a currency? Is it an investment vehicle? The regulation. Number two is less volatility. There's just so much volatility. People may like, you know, stuff going up, but actually as an asset allocator, financial service company, if they're going to put in 60-40, they don't want so much volatility, because they also realize if it goes up that quickly, it can also go down. And especially when you're placing in that 40 bucket that generally has lower volatility. So regulation, less volatility. And obviously lastly is education. A lot of the financial institutions, a lot of investors still don't know what blockchain is or what Bitcoin is and how it fits. And that will take time. So almost all three of those buckets will take time before you see mass adoption. You always will see, you know, early investors, and we're definitely seeing that, and they're taking toeholds in certain blockchain technologies or digital currencies.
Well, and I'll just pick up on that and Max ask you to go through a little bit of the underpinning is obviously the blockchain technology. And there are many other currencies, cryptocurrencies that use that. Can you go into sort of sketching out for us what we need to know, what investors need to know about the blockchain technology that's there, how useful it is, sort of its importance, you know, put it in context where we keep hearing Bitcoin, but really put blockchain in context for us.
That's a great question. I think in technology, people often think to analogies. And the analogy here would be, what is Bitcoin built on? It's built on this distributed database. So it effectively is some type of database technology. And instead of storing information in one central repository, it's stored in multiple locations around the world, which creates this embedded increase in trust. That's why Bitcoin, we feel, had such a great start in the financial system. As an application, it replaced, or it's a substitute in addition to the fiat currency system, which effectively is centralized. We have central banks that print the currency that are responsible for its circulation. Bitcoin has no central bank. It's governed by a set of rules which were set out in that white paper. And so its existence sits in a different structure, in that distributed structure. Its popularity has spawned new blockchains, and we've mentioned that a little bit on the webcast so far. I think the important thing to think about, and the way it's being contextualized, is Bitcoin might be this native currency of the internet, and all these other blockchains become the secondary currencies. And Bitcoin becomes almost like the US dollar of the internet. That's sort of the way it's being spoken about in terms of analogies. Obviously, we are far from that being going mainstream. And there are a lot of hurdles. I think Nick spoke really well about the on-ramps, if you will, the things that connect the traditional system with the distributed system. But these are things that continue to develop, and they're compounding on themselves year after year.
Nick, you look at the financials, you look at the financial sector. What kind of disruption does Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies represent to the financial sector, if at all?
Right. I think the best way to think about it is it has the potential to be disruptive, because basically what is being built here are new rails for storing, moving money around, even in the latest kind of frontier, the decentralized finance world, coordinating capital, whether you're talking about lending, borrowing, investing, exchanges, all in a decentralized fashion, all through code and the incentives that the tokens provide. So again, this is still very early days, but every time you have new rails to do something, it's a potentially a competitive threat. And the trade-offs here are the cost of the decentralization is probably more costly, because as Max mentioned, you're having to replicate these database on multiple computers. So it's not as efficient as running an application on a central server. But this is the cost. The benefit you get is the decentralization, sort of the lack of the need to trust another party. So I think as basically the cost of running operations on blockchains goes down, and we will see more and more applications emerge. We'll see some traditional companies again embrace it. We talked about Fidelity being in the custody part. We talked about PayPal enabling customers to buy Bitcoin. CME is a major exchange. They have launched futures on Bitcoin and Ethereum. So some companies are embracing it. Some are dismissing it as a potential threat. And we'll see where it goes. I think it will be very different 5 and 10 years down the road.
Well, I'll need to step in on the custodial side of it. You know, sketch out for us and if what investors need to know. Again, we might go to passcodes in a second and losing those, but just sort of the nature of what investors might expect in terms of some comfort, some sleep at night, that there is a custodial process that is trusted. What needs to be done on that front?
It's a great question, Pamela. And I think this is one of those interesting things that normally you never worry about. Like, I bought a stock or I have cash in the bank account, it's going to be there tomorrow. So one of the subtle things, as Max has mentioned, is that a digital currency, especially Bitcoin, what's great about it is also what's bad about it. And so let me explain, is that it doesn't sit somewhere in your wallet, your physical wallet. So it's out there in the digital world, and you have a passcode, essentially a key, to unlock it. And this is, we've heard, obviously in the news, some people lose their keys. And if you lose your key, that's the whole point, is that no bank could touch it. No central banker could touch it. But if you forget your key, you can't get it either. And so if you're going to be involved with this, sometimes is that, I think more than ever, and you want a custodial firm to look after it, I would look very closely who they are and how much trust you put into them, because they are owning your digital currencies. And it's digital. It's a lot easier to steal digital currencies than physical gold bars. I think this is where we are very early in the innings. I think you have to do a lot of analysis on things that people generally wouldn't worry about, but it's custodials. And it's who is actually holding my currency, and do I trust them? And more importantly, what are their safeguards? Could someone come in and actually steal my digital currency from them because they don't have the right passcodes or the right protection as well?
Max, pick up on, I'm sure you never lose your password to anything. I mean, I'm sure you have a foolproof system and that you've never had to ask for a new passcode from anything. But for those of us that do, first of all, it's not called a password. Tell us what it's called. It's your key. But actually, generally, just go into that for a minute. Like, how big of a deal is this?
Yeah, it's a huge deal. I think a lot of research suggests that somewhere upwards of 15% of Bitcoins are effectively lost. They're in wallets that you can see on the blockchain, but no one can access because they don't have the key. So what Joe was referring to is that each wallet holds Bitcoins on the blockchain, has two addresses. It has a public key, which it's referred to as, and then it has a private key that allows you to unlock that wallet. And so these are both cryptographic hashes. They're long strings of variables, and they are incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to guess. And so that means that if you lose that private key or you lose access to it, as Joe mentioned, your coins are gone, which effectively has also contributed to volatility in Bitcoin itself. We saw a very high profile failure of an exchange whose private keys got hacked, called Mt. Gox. We saw one in here in Canada called Quadriga several years ago. And keeping those keys safe is of utmost importance. But I think in a broader context, it's also reinforced why cybersecurity is another big application on top of blockchain. It's something that's being focused on right now as we use more remote computing, but it's also something that's going to come into much greater focus around storing crypto assets.
Nick, I'll ask you to wade into this a little bit. So, I mean, we know that most countries are working on cryptocurrencies. China, for sure, is trying it out already. The Bank of England has been one of the more forthcoming, although no one's totally forthcoming, on the fact that they're working on it. Most countries are. Do the countries' new versions of cryptocurrencies and maybe the connection with the banking system in each country, which is, where does that all fit? Is there a disruption there? Do the national cryptocurrencies compete with Bitcoin? Can we kind of go back to those different layers of how a country is built?
Yeah, that will be a really interesting space to follow in the next couple of years. Many central banks around the world, including the Bank of Canada, have stated that they want to develop a central bank digital currency. So maybe to level set where that fits relative to the current system, today there's two forms of money. You have central bank money, but it's not in digital form. It's basically the coins and bills in your pocket. And then what we think of digital money are actually bank deposits. So yes, it's digital, but it's an IOU of the bank. So there's a level of credit risk there. And you're also constrained by the basically the constraints of the bank, whether they're technological, the fact that it can take 2 days for money to move in someone else's account, as well as all the fee structure they may impose on your account and for transactions. What this new paradigm of a retail central bank digital currency would be the central banks directly issuing a digital currency to the citizens. So there are a couple impacts. First of all, I think what you can see there is potentially, depending on the design of the CBDC, it could be somewhat disruptive to the way that the banks fund themselves. Because now if I can own my money digitally directly with the central bank, I may not be interested in paying fees to a bank to safeguard my money. So that's one aspect. The other aspect will be, it will be very interesting to see how this will play out in terms of fiscal and monetary policy. Today, you know, the central bank plays with interest rate. It's very hard sometimes to see the impact between the interest rates and the direct impact it has on the economy. Maybe they overstimulate housing relative to other parts of the economy. What if they could put a digital currency directly in your wallet, and not only money, but programmable money, where they could say, you know, here's your $1,000 stimulus, but I don't want you to use it to, you know, invest in, speculate in the stock market, as many people have done. What we want to achieve, the goal is maybe you have to spend it within a month to a local business. Otherwise, it'll disappear. So, I mean, this is a few years out, but I think the emergence of central bank digital currencies could have a profound impact on how monetary and fiscal policy is being deployed.
You know, Joe, I want to go to you to ask a little bit about the gold versus Bitcoin question, which seems to fly around a lot. I know that you take a very good look at a lot of the miners in this country. It's an area, obviously, to store value. Are the gold companies worried about Bitcoin and the like?
Pamela, on the gold companies themselves, and probably just the gold industry, they're generally not too worried right now about Bitcoin because it's so early on. But it's something they're doing a lot of work on and watching, because essentially, to your point, we said, you know, a number of ways here why someone would generally invest in gold for a number of reasons: negative real rates, they're negative on the US dollar. Generally, it's an alternative currency. They don't feel, and more importantly, for some people, they like it because, you know, they'll put in a vault and they'll hide it. And so when you talk about digital currencies, if digital currencies do what they're supposed to do, which is, of course, be an alternative currency, and more importantly, be away from, you know, the view of banks and central banks and governments, it could do the same thing in a very, very easier manner, because, again, it's very easy to move it, and maybe potentially easier to move on the rails than, say, gold. Gold generally isn't used too much for actual purchases these days. It's more just being held in someone's vault or held in an ETF. So I think it's very early on, but it's something I know even our gold team is looking very closely at, just, again, making sure Fidelity, we're ahead of this.
There's so many questions. So we've hit most of them, you know, how it fits with the banks. I'm going to go to this one, Max, for you, because it's sort of a discussion around the idea of how many Bitcoins will be produced. There is a scarcity element to it, and there's sort of this exponential theory that goes along with it that has it valued into the future at you know, going exponential when more people in rural communities and all the corners of the earth are online and therefore can access it at the moment they can. Where does this go potentially?
Yeah, that's a great question. The rules around it are that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin minted, and that mining reward, which increases the supply, will get lower and lower and lower over time. So the supply looks like this asymptote to 21 million. What does that mean for the future? Well, you know, Bitcoin is priced in US dollars. That's how we quote it. So asking what's the future of Bitcoin is the same as inverting the question and saying, what will happen to the US dollar? Will the US dollar remain the world's reserve currency? Will it maintain its supremacy? I mean, though that becomes a big geopolitical question in addition to a policy and monetary issue question. And we'll see, you know, how that plays out. I think the supply of US dollars is up somewhere around 35-40% year over year. So a lot of things priced in US dollars have gone up, including Bitcoin. But we don't know how that policy will unfold over the coming years. And that's something that we're watching closely.
Nick, I'll ask you to weigh in on sort of it's kind of the international trade discussion around it. So do deals one day not get priced in the Russian ruble? If China's buying something, do they actually get priced in Bitcoin? And again, what does that mean for banks who are doing these deals?
I mean, some Bitcoiners would love to see Bitcoin be the world's reserve currency. I think we have a long way to go if we ever go there. I think as of now, I don't think any central bank is embracing Bitcoin as a reserve asset. This may change, or it may go the other way, where governments, you know, they like to have the monopoly on money, and they decide to go a completely other direction where they want to, you know, impair the use of Bitcoin. It's very hard to shut down Bitcoin because, as we said, it's decentralized. It lives on the internet. So you would have to shut down the internet to shut down Bitcoin, but you can impair the use of it. So I think we're very far from a world where Bitcoin would be the global unit of account. I think there's probably more potential in terms of what we discuss, where there are national digital currencies, where perhaps, you know, like China is certainly ahead of it in terms of rolling out their national digital currency. And could that help them gain a bigger role in terms of pricing international trade? We know the US dollar is really oversized in terms of its size in international trade relative to the size of the United States. So there is a bit of a race there in terms of who can come up with the best potentially digital currency, and that could have an impact on how deals are priced globally. But I think it's too early to make a prediction on that.
Okay. And Joe, I'm going to come to you in a minute to sort of help us think about this as we walk away and take all these pieces of information. But Max, there's a question coming in. I want you to just take a crack at this. It's a huge question. You have 30 seconds. Can you leverage on the digital currency? You know, can it have a house call if it falls? This goes into, you know, Bitcoin essentially, yeah, being used as leverage. Is that, you see that playing out, if at all?
Yes, I mean, there is a market to borrow Bitcoin effectively. I mean, CME futures, if you sell futures, you can be effectively leveraged. We've seen really interesting way of financing in the crypto ecosystem using fiat money. So I'll just touch upon that briefly. We've seen some exchanges offer interest rates on US dollar deposits upwards of 5-7%, which sounds very appealing. And that money is effectively used to build out their operations, which enable people to purchase more cryptocurrencies. And so that those high interest rates on US dollar deposits are effectively a type of high risk or high cost debt that exists in the crypto ecosystem. And that's effectively leverage. So this system, I think part of the beauty of it for the Bitcoin purists is that much of it isn't levered. You know, it's the exact inverse of our fiat financial system that has lots of debt. But there is some debt that underpins the value of Bitcoin today.
Thank you. That's fascinating. Joe, what tie this up in a bow for us? This is a lot of information. You know, what do you want investors to sort of go away and know that Fidelity is sort of doing on this front? Like, how should we think about this?
Pamela, I think investors should take away that Fidelity is on top of this. Much like many things we look at, we want to be doing a lot of analysis, what could hurt, what could help. We have with us, of course, Max, who takes care of technology. We have Nick, who takes care of the banks and financials. We have Lulu, who's not with us, but she takes care of her gold. All of them just in Canada are definitely watching this space and what could be a positives or negatives. And of course, even I say corporately, we're looking at it and globally, we're looking at it. And I think I just want to be, you know, very clear that sometimes it's not even the exact Bitcoin or blockchain. There could be companies that would enable this technology. It could even be a bank who uses it in a positive way and differentiates themselves versus their peers, or a technology company that helps people buy this currency and hold it in a very protective way. So there's a number of companies that could be offshoots or different angles that we're looking at very closely. It is early, but that's the Philly way. We want to be ahead of the game. Thanks.
Joe Overdeves, Max Adelson, and Nick Bellmare, I want to thank all of you very much for this fulsome discussion. I have a feeling there could be a part two in the making. It's a huge topic and a huge area of interest. Thanks again, and we'll see you all soon. Thanks for joining us here. I'm Pamela Ritchie.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.